And here we are back for hour number two today on this first day of May 2019. Will April showers bring May flowers? We hope, because we had, I think we had our fill of April showers. We've got a great guest this hour, but I do want to remind you that our big, amazing May Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ticket giveaway will continue on, started today, continue on through Friday, May the 10th. Listen to every show on this station, and if you answer a trivia question right, you can be entered to win two tickets to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We will draw the winner on Friday, May the 10th at 2:15 p.m. on this station, but you can enter as many times as you like. If you answer the trivia questions right, you can win a chance to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and you have 10 days to do so, so good luck. Now, this hour is going to be a great hour because we're going to talk about what's going on in the state of Ohio, what's going on nationally in the world of politics with a gentleman who hasn't been on this show, I think, since about 3 days before Election Day 2018. It's always a pleasure to welcome to these microphones the Ohio Democratic Party Chairman, David Pepper. David, how are you?
I'm great. How you doing?
It's good to talk with you. Is it nice where you are, nice weather where you are today?
Yeah, it is nice looking out the window here. Pretty sunny and warm. Sounds like we got rain coming all across Ohio, though.
It does. We're not getting away from the April showers yet.
Yeah, no, I heard the forecast. So we don't have flooding.
Well, that's right. We don't want that. David, there's so much going on nationally and locally, but I want to start here real quick because the last time we spoke, I think was about 3 days, maybe 2 days before the 2018 election. And there was a very positive feeling about Rich Cordray becoming governor. There was a very positive feeling about Danny O'Connor doing very well in a district that encompasses part of Marion County here. There was a good feeling that Jim Jordan would not win by such a large margin. Secretary of State, Attorney General, all those offices. And it didn't end up that way. What happened?
Well, you know, it was not what we would have wanted. At the same time, we also had a good feeling about Sherrod Brown, and he got reelected by 7. We, for the first time this decade, we actually flipped 6 House seats from red to blue. We also, for the first time in a long time, won 2 Ohio Supreme Court seats, but we obviously wanted to win everything. I would say what happened, and this is something that is just, I think the reality is you know, Donald Trump in the last 6-7 weeks of the election made the election about himself, and he talked a lot about that caravan, and it led to a higher turnout on the Republican side than people anticipated. And you know, I think really saved the day for Mike DeWine and even Troy Balderson. But it also, if you look around the country, you know, there were races in Florida where we were ahead, our candidate for governor there, Indiana, Missouri, our Senate candidates were about tied. They all ended up losing. Mike DeWine himself was told with a week to go by his own pollsters, I've heard this from many people, that he was going to lose. The undecided votes were breaking Cordray's way. So I think, you know, Donald Trump made the election about himself. And in a lot of America, that cost Republicans. That's why one reason that the Democrats won 40 House seats around the country. But in other parts where you have, you know, large areas where people like Donald Trump, he actually saved candidates who otherwise might have been in trouble. There was not a lot of energy for Governor DeWine late in the race. He knew it. Again, his pollsters knew it. Donald Trump, I think, coming here, making about himself, giving people a reason to vote when they weren't that excited about Mike DeWine, I think did make a difference. And, you know, that's something the Democrats are just going to contend with. There are voters out there that obviously listened to him, and when he said it was important, they showed up. But as I said, in some parts of our state and country, the fact that it was about him actually cost elections, Republican elections, especially those 40 House seats that changed the makeup of the Congress.
Well, there was
at the same time, I will say, you know, we were very excited to have some wins, and one of the things that's beneath the surface, even those statewide candidates you mentioned who lost, they all achieved we had a very high turnout on the Democratic side. They together, you know, we've only won one statewide midterm in decades. This was the most competitive midterm result Democrats have had since 06 and one of the closest in decades. So it was actually Richard Cordray, Kathleen Clyde, and the whole group were a very strong set of candidates. And they ran more competitively than any group has in 12 years. And Danny O'Connor, I mean, that's a district that just a few years ago you wouldn't even expect to have a conversation. It's so gerrymandered. And the outcome was actually close to the end. So he way overperformed what is usually a district that the Republicans have won by, you know, 15, 20, 25 to 30 points.
One of the things before we move away from this that I found interesting on that night, because I think most people in the media felt that Cordray was going to win. It was just a matter of how much he was going to win by. And Georgia and Florida were what they were. But if you, as you say, if you look at the map, the election of 2016, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, states that all surround us, who a lot of people have considered more Democratic, but in the presidential election that elected Donald Trump did not go Democratic, came back to their Democratic roots, right. It seemed, but Ohio didn't. Why was that?
Well, you know, we've always been, I would say, somewhere between Wisconsin and, let's say, Indiana. And we still were. You know, we reelected a senator by 7. Claire McCaskill lost badly in Missouri. Mo Donnelly lost in Indiana. So, and in Florida, they lost both their governor and their senate race. We won one and lost one. So if you look at the spectrum, you know, this is getting into the weeds of the map, but Pennsylvania and Michigan have always been, you know, a good deal more to the Democratic camp than us. Then there's Wisconsin. And then we're more in the middle, kind of like Florida. And Georgia is a little more to the right, and Indiana and Missouri. And we sort of felt where we always do. You know, we won some, you know, some places. Wisconsin just had a special election the other day. They lost the Democratic candidate for Supreme Court. So we won some. We picked up, we hadn't flipped one House seat from red to blue the entire decade in Ohio. We flipped 6. So, you know, we wanted to win it all. It was a gut punch for Democrats to have great candidates lose, even though they were very competitive. But I would argue that if you look closely, you know, Scott Walker barely lost in Wisconsin, so they were very close. And Cordray lost by something like 3.5, and Sherrod won by 7. So if you look at how we fit into other states, we fit into where we normally are in the spectrum. The only big change, the biggest changes in national politics in the last decade are that states like Colorado and Virginia have marched to being pretty solidly blue. So that's the big difference. But Florida, you know, we won a race. We won Senate, lost governor. They lost both. So arguably we were more blue than Florida was. You know, Arizona, which is now being talked about as sort of a swing state, well, their Senate candidate won by 1. Ours won by 7. Their governor candidate lost by 14. Ours lost by a little more than 3. So I would actually say that we performed about where we have. You know, do we wish we'd won it all? Sure. But the other thing that I would say, if you look closely at the performance of all of our candidates, but particularly the ones that were on the ballot, let's say this year and in 12. So the last year that Ohio was blue was 2012, when Barack Obama was reelected. Sherrod Brown actually did better. He won by more in 18 than he did in 12. We won both Supreme Court races in 18. We didn't in 12. We flipped 6 House seats in 18. We lost one in 12. The truth is, and this goes back to why Danny O'Connor ran such a good race in Delaware County, if you look closely at our comparison to any year this decade, including 2012, we are seeing a major realignment politically where Republicans in the suburbs are flocking towards Democrats. The state House seats that we won were basically in the suburbs, seats that were districts that just a few years would have been considered very safe Republican districts, Franklin County being a good example, districts gerrymandered for Republicans to win. And in this case, you know, in Franklin County, for example, there were 3 districts that went from red to blue. The Democrats won them each by more than double digits. So between the state house activity and Donald Trump, we are seeing a major shift in voters in the suburbs that used to be Republican strongholds now moving our way. That's why Sherrod did better than he did in 12, and that's why we picked up state house seats rather than losing them. So as a net overall pattern, we are seeing more voters coming to us than moving away from us versus any time this decade. So the trend line, unless you know the Republicans dramatically change what they're doing, I think the trend line is actually we were less red than we've been any time this decade, and we're moving even more in the blue category. And that's why you see wins and things that we've struggled to win, not just sheriffs, but state houses, Supreme Court, that we haven't seen in about a decade.
I would think if you're a Democrat in Ohio, if you look what's happened in the past few years and looking toward the future, this off-year election where a lot of Democrats will be up for re-election, mayors and things of that nature, as well as 2020, when you look at that map of Ohio, one of the things that's always so fascinating, and it was that way in 2018, and it was the same way in 2014 in the gubernatorial races, Democrats win in Franklin County, Democrats win in Cleveland, Democrats win in Cincinnati, but in the rural area, when you look, or I don't want to call them all rural areas, right, but when you look at that map, just about every other county, with very few exceptions, are all red.
Right.
What do Democrats have to do to fix that problem?
So they have to do what Sherrod Brown does. They have to talk to people where they are, understand the struggles of these communities, campaign in those places, and really perform and be there. And I give credit to Mike DeWine. He campaigns all over the state very aggressively, and I think Democrats have to do the same thing. One thing we already are working on is a rural caucus that we're putting together to make sure that our candidates are always better at campaigning in our smaller towns and our rural communities. But to tell you the truth, you know, Barack Obama did quite well in our rural parts of our state. The answer is we will generally lose most counties of Ohio. People know that. That's sort of the way our state is demographically spread out. The question is how much do you lose the places that you probably will lose, and by how much do you win the places that you should win if you're a Democrat? And, you know, the worst-case scenario was the Hillary Clinton campaign. She lost the rural parts of our state by about 73% to 27%. Barack Obama lost those same areas 60-40. He kept it within range so that when he had very big numbers in our larger urban areas, he could win. If you do not do enough in those areas and they really do not respond well to you, and you lose them in the way that they were lost in 16, the truth is the election's over. You cannot win. There are not enough Democrats in your larger counties to make up for that. Sherrod Brown had a similar pattern. He lost those more rural areas by a lot less. And the reason Cordray was a lot closer than Hillary Clinton was, and far closer than 2014, is because he also made some inroads there. But there's no doubt you have to do better there. You have to do more like Sherrod did than Rich Cordray to win. But Rich Cordray certainly performed better than in 16. 14 was obviously a blowout, so one other way to compare is the result. You know, 14, the race was called within 10 seconds of the polls closing. 18, it was quite close. But the other big area I would tell you that you have to do well in is not just, you know, your quintessential rural small town, but also the suburbs that are growing. And this is where we're seeing that growth I talked about. We are seeing, you know, Delaware County, 10 years ago, if you got to the mid-30s in Delaware County as a Democrat, you were doing well. Sherrod and Danny O'Connor got to the mid-40s. That is a huge Republican county, or was, and now it's shifting our way. So you have to do better in our rural areas, but I also think that another big area for growth for Democrats is in these growing suburbs, the fastest-growing communities of our state, the suburbs outside of our major cities, where voters, and particularly women, are no longer seeing in the Republican Party what they used to be happy to vote for. You know, people who would have voted for Mitt Romney or even a George W. Bush, who now watch Donald Trump or this gerrymandered statehouse and think that's no longer the party I recognize. And those are voters who are moving towards Danny O'Connor or Sherrod Brown, to the extent that those guys got to 45% each. And we almost won a state senate race with a great candidate named Louise Valentine in a district a few years ago you would have thought you had no chance. So, the big picture is that as the Republican Party, frankly, moves to a more extreme direction, they are losing a lot of the suburban areas that used to be their stronghold. So our goal is to do a better job, talking to voters in rural parts of the state and small towns. And by the way, these, and Marion's one of them, a lot of these small towns, they have had this state government pick their pockets of their revenues for years and use it to give away tax cuts and loopholes, or, you know, put in a rainy day fund. And one of the great issues for me in this state that needs to be addressed is our smaller towns. Excuse me. What is their recipe for success in the 21st century? Many of them are struggling. Some are fortunate to have a major manufacturer left or university, but many others lost their major manufacturer decades ago. Their young people are leaving. And rather than helping these towns, the state of Ohio is taking the funds from their local funds to spend on state priorities and not back in these communities. So I think it's especially problematic if Democrats aren't getting that message to these towns, because they're often the ones literally paying through the nose for Republican leadership that is taking from them as opposed to supporting and investing them. And Mike DeWine's doing the same thing. He just got elected governor on the strength of some of what you talked about, and he already has said he's going to keep the policy going of John Kasich of, you know, taking money from Marion's pocket as opposed to investing back in Marion. And to me, so much of the fabric of this state is made up in these wonderful small mid-sized towns that populate all across our state.
I want to come to Mike DeWine here in a second, because he certainly has done a few interesting things in the first few days of his governorship this year. But this is a question I think we're all asking ourselves as we head into 2020. Certainly the biggest story of 2016 was Donald Trump, and he's entertaining and says things that are, I think, people consider to be far-right ideas. And in 2018, I think a lot of people would argue the biggest story was Cortez, AOC, who seemed to have far Democratic ideas and said things out of the blue. And the knock on Rich Cordray that I always heard was he was too boring. Do you have to be entertaining to win an election these days?
You know, that's a great question. And my answer is actually, I mean, you should be, I think it helps to be charismatic. But I think the most important thing is that people think you're fighting for them on the issues they care about. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of focus on a few members of Congress on the Democratic side. And some, you know, Fox News loves to focus on AOC. But the truth is, there were 40 people who flipped seats from red to blue. That wasn't AOC. She won a primary in a district that Democrats win no matter what. But 40 candidates flipped seats from red to blue. And they don't get as much of attention. But most of them won in the same way that Danny O'Connor campaigned. They were running on the bread and butter issues that really matter to people, whether it be pre-existing conditions, whether it be, you know, health care costs, how do we get good jobs, how do we help young people. These are people who I would think, you know, most people would find practical, down to earth. A lot of them were veterans. A lot of them were first-time candidates. A whole lot of women won. But I don't think these people, you know, meet the bill of being the you know, great entertainers. But what they did do was capture to people, hey, we want people who reflect our interest in the day-to-day things that make a difference in our lives. And they campaigned very sincerely and earnestly. And they won 40 seats, many of which were gerrymandered 9 years ago for Republicans, and they won it by doing those things. And I think the recipe, and that gets lost now because I support the media. I don't mean to criticize here, but I do think the media often goes to the most sort of electric person. But the heart of the big Democratic wins last November was not the AOC type candidate. It was actually these 40 that flipped seats from red to blue. That I think by winning in suburbs just like Delaware County or the suburbs of Franklin County with probably not quite the same type of approach. So we're a Big Ten party. We have all that within our party, but I think those candidates would strike people as you know, down to earth, the kind of person they might run into in their grocery store who in their own family is dealing with pre-existing conditions, the cost of health care, and just wants to solve them. And they don't get as much attention on the national scene, but I think that's the heart of who won in 2018.
It's very interesting. Mike DeWine has not been governor quite 4 months yet, and he has done two big things that made a lot of attention, caused a lot of stir. I want to start, number one, with the gas tax. Now, this was interesting because I had not heard about this until he came out with it. And it seemed as when he first rolled the idea for this out that his own party, his own legislature, didn't really like this idea. They came to terms on it finally. But did the Democratic Party see that coming during the election?
Well, no one did because Mike DeWine was very clear. And by the way, something, I don't know if you saw this, a few days ago there was a poll that came out that found that Mike DeWine is already one of the least popular governors in the country. And I think one reason that happened is, you know, you would not have anticipated that his first act essentially would be a tax increase, because then I'm looking at an article in front of me. He literally said late in the campaign to quote, this is a speech he gave in St. Clairsville with 2 weeks to go, I'm not looking to increase taxes. He spent the entire fall accusing Rich Cordray of wanting to raise taxes and saying, I won't raise taxes. It's a quote, and he would say it all over, and he in Houston would say, well, Cordray's going to raise taxes, avoid that, vote for us. So no, I would tell you that I assume usually people try and keep their promises at least for some amount of time. But in the first 100 days, here a guy who promised the whole campaign he wouldn't raise taxes, said don't vote for Cordray because he plans to, he goes and raised taxes, and my guess is he knew all along that he was going to do this. And so, you know, some Democrats voted for the gas tax, others did not feel comfortable doing so, but I will say none of them were campaigning against taxes in the way that DeWine did. It really reminded me of George Bush, the first George Bush, who I generally respected, but he did basically lose partly because he said, read my lips, no new taxes, and then went and raised taxes. And that's frankly exactly what Mike DeWine did. So my guess is Democrats were surprised because they heard what he said. And my guess is Republicans were very surprised because he had told Republicans throughout the fall the reason they should vote for him and help him and line up to turn out the vote for him was because he wouldn't raise taxes and Rich Cordray planned to. And then within a month, he's telling Republicans at the State House, hey, guys, you better raise taxes or you're bad people. So I think voters don't like that of either party. And I think that it's one reason why his numbers right now as a governor aren't very good, because it's, as you point out, it's probably of the average person who doesn't have time to watch Columbus and has their own life to lead, the one thing they probably know right now is that Mike DeWine raised their gas tax. And those paying attention know that he did that even though he promised he wouldn't.
The other thing I think we all saw coming, if Mike DeWine was going to be elected, because it had been put in front of Governor Kasich and he had decided not to sign it, was the heartbeat bill. And this is kind of confusing because I think for a lot of people who don't, as you say, follow Columbus every day or follow C-SPAN or the networks here in Ohio that cover the news, is that Mike DeWine signed this into law that if they can detect a fetal heartbeat, which is essentially all pregnancies, that you cannot have an abortion. But to my knowledge, the abortion clinics have not closed in Ohio. So what was the purpose of this?
I mean, this goes back to why I think Republicans are losing so quickly in the suburbs. This was a piece of legislation that John Kasich vetoed because he knew it would lead to, under at least current president, being struck down as unconstitutional in a long and lengthy lawsuit. Believe it or not, Ohio Right to Life for years opposed this for the same reason. This is, basically they are, it's a ban. This is, they're calling it names to make it sound better, but this is basically an outright ban on abortion services and reproductive services. It's basically saying to women, even in the worst scenarios of rape or incest, you basically are not allowed to have an abortion or even talk to your doctor who might guide you to have one after 6 weeks, but we all know that you don't know you're pregnant until after 6 weeks. So it cuts it off entirely. And that is something that clearly violates the Constitution. And Mike DeWine, though, and as you said, he broke his promise on the taxes line. This was something he did say he would do. And he did it in a way that prior governors weren't comfortable. And I think what it's going to do is lead to, Mike DeWine spent much of his time as Attorney General in federal court fighting for his sort of ideological views using taxpayer dollars. And he lost almost all those cases. And I think that's what's going to happen again here. I think we are going to watch Ohio. You know, we got all this need. We can invest in so many things. But I think Ohioans are about to take a long, expensive ride in the courts, being sued, and ultimately, I believe, losing, because this is such an extreme bill. It's basically an outright ban. And you know, that's bad enough, but also with no exceptions for rape or incest. So basically, the ban takes place, is triggered before women even know that they're pregnant, and that's the bottom line of it. This is what Mike DeWine has done in his career, and you know, this is certainly something I would have expected, even though I do think it's the reason once again that that Republicans are losing so many voters in suburbs, particularly women, who see this as way beyond what they want to see the legislature or governor like DeWine doing.
It's hard to believe, but this is May the 1st, so we can officially say this as of today, that the first Democratic primary for president will happen next month in June, so we're going to be underway. And Ohio, always very important, always very heavily marketed by both sides in presidential elections. What do you see so far in the Democratic primary? Joe Biden in the lead, just over in Indiana, Buttigieg getting a lot of attention, Mayor Pete. Beto got some when he announced. Bernie's in there. What do you think so far of the Democrats who have announced?
You know, it's a great group of people. I mean, we obviously are a big tent, which I think is a strength. Obviously, Democrats, like any party is, when you have a big field, you're obviously hoping that people don't go so against each other that we have a hard time unifying. But I'm confident that will not be a problem come the spring. But it's a really, you know, we have a good bench of people, and it covers obviously multiple generations. There's a candidate for just about every viewpoint in the party, and then some. I'll be honest, I'm excited to see Tim Ryan running. He's from Ohio. He's a good candidate. I think I mentioned earlier the concern about smaller towns in our country, in our state. I think candidates like Tim Ryan from Youngstown and Pete Buttigieg from South Bend, they know the language. Pete's obviously the mayor of South Bend. They know the language, and they know the concerns of these smaller towns. So my hope is, as people watch the group, they're going to see that there's a broad swath in this party but all of whom are fighting for better futures for our communities, including like those in Ohio. I'll say this, though. I think that Donald Trump, although for a while people thought it was sort of amusing, but there were 17 Republicans running in that primary, and Donald Trump ended up winning. All of a sudden, it became clear that the energy and the attention paid to all those candidates provided a whole lot of energy to Donald Trump once he emerged as the winner. There were many more people who voted in the Republican primary, for example. And I think we're going to have the same impact on the Democratic side. I think in the end, you know, it's clear that Joe Biden's the favorite. He's had a strong start. But all these candidates, I think, will get people signed up, people working, people energized. And as long as people unify, and that'll be my number one concern as a party chair, I think a primary like this, if done the right way, in high profile, energized, actually gives you a lot of momentum going into next fall. And that's exactly how Donald Trump benefited from it. And I think we should see that in our case as well.
There's another political theory that's interesting, and I think that's been going around. A lot of people say that in 2016, there were 17 candidates in the Republican primary, and one of the problems was when the primary season started that all the people who were traditional Republicans had 16 people to choose from, so the vote was split 16 different ways. Donald Trump was certainly different, so he was able to become the front runner. We are going to have more Democrats now than Republicans had in 2016. I think we're over 20 now, maybe close to 30.
Right.
And
not quite, but yeah.
Yeah. Is it going to be where somebody who I think they would say would be a fringe candidate, and I only say this because, I mean, he is obviously outwardly gay, like Mayor Pete, a mayor who normally, that's unusual for a presidential primary. could walk in and win this thing because people like Joe Biden, who are in the middle, and a lot of other people in that group, Kamala Harris, Gillibrand, Cory Booker, who maybe they consider themselves centrist in the Democratic Party, might split that in so many different ways that you get somebody who maybe is a, what I think what they would call more of a socialist now.
You know, as I watch the primary, and again, we're neutral, so I don't want to, I'm not here to weigh in on one side or another, but you know, I think the winner's going to be the winner, and whoever can in a combination of ways convince people they're not only that their views are the right direction for our country, but also they're the most likely to beat Donald Trump. I think that person will win, and that's who obviously came for paying for next year. And I think the strongest winner will get there not through just a narrow campaign. I think the person who comes out of this will be the one who somehow figured out how, among 20 people or more, to build a broad coalition. I think in the end, may the best person win, and that person then carries the day. I will say, though, I think much more than in most primaries that you and I have witnessed, there is, and some will like this, some won't, but there is a much deeper, concern about who can beat Donald Trump. And, you know, obviously the Republican listeners don't want to have him beaten, but Democrats, that's going to be the number one goal. Who can beat him? Who can stand on the debate stage and go toe-to-toe with him? And I think a lot of, not all, but a lot of Democratic voters are going to look at this and say, okay, I know there's some differences on these different candidates. They have different stories, but the differences are less large than the number one concern, which is we want a new president in January 2021. And I think a lot of the conversation will come back to that. And I think one reason Joe Biden probably in the last couple weeks has vaulted to a lead is because a lot of the people who support him think he's the guy who can win. Even if they don't agree with everything he's ever done or that he plans to do, I think the concern about beating Donald Trump is so great that that attribute of being a guy that people think, or a woman that people think can win, and then a ticket that can win, will for many be the dominant issue more than whatever viewpoints, you know, whatever health care plan they have or whatever climate change plan they have, because there are going to be a whole wide variety of them. And so I think that is true more than in most campaigns. Most campaigns, I think, you know, people like to say Republicans fall in line and Democrats fall in love. You know, Democrats get excited about the person who most excites them. And that's going to play a factor here, too. But I think Democratic voters will also be really picky about, okay, we know where they stand. Can they win?
Before we move on to President Trump for our last 10 minutes here, I think it's important to talk about Joe Biden for this reason, because he's just announced in recent times. And also, there are some questions here, because yes, he is the front runner, without doubt. If you believe the polls, he certainly is the front runner. No debates have obviously happened yet. But in 2008, President Obama was not the front runner. Mm-hmm. When that started, Hillary Clinton was. And it's interesting that Joe Biden would be 78 years old when he took office. Now, not being an ageist, but that's certainly the oldest president we've ever had, would be 82 when he completed his first term. He has been vice president for 8 years. He certainly is an establishment guy. Is that going to be appealing to this new swath of Democratic voters who seem to come out in 2018?
I think that's a toss-up question. I mean, I think that if I were advising Joe Biden, I'd say you cannot run resting on your laurels or the past, because I do think, you know, there are some voters who will be with Joe Biden no matter what because they think he's the most likely to win, but others are looking for, you know, bold ideas on issues that are of concern right now that haven't yet been solved. And so, you know, if I were Joe Biden, or I would advise Joe Biden, I'd say, listen, people know you. They respect that you were with Obama, and they greatly respect the work of the Obama administration. But you also need to have a future-oriented campaign to appeal to voters who want more than just someone they already know. And so I think that sometimes in the past, campaigns like Joe Biden have come into primaries just sort of expecting that because they're known that everyone's going to rally. And I think that is, we've seen people lose who did that. I mean, I'll just throw out a Republican. People thought Jeb Bush would just go right on in there. He was the favorite. And obviously that ended very quickly. So I think that if you're someone like that, that you're sort of the favorite, you're a little more establishment, I think you need to really don't think you're that and go in with a future-oriented mindset so that those new voters who, frankly, a lot of voters didn't even vote when wouldn't even been old enough to vote. And we have a lot of young voters, very energized. So they never voted for Obama. And Biden needs to go win them over. And so I think it's... I think there is a trap for candidates who are really well known, who are going to have some advantage at the beginning just because they are well known, that they can get caught up pretty quickly by someone else. And we saw that again. You know, who were the best known candidates a couple years ago? It was Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. And at first, Trump was sort of this sideshow at 2%. Well, he ran over all of them. And I think that if you're that favorite, you need to really be thoughtful that it's got to be more than just I'm known. And you know, obviously, I would think the Joe Biden campaign would be wise enough to know that.
With 7 minutes left here, David, there are two questions I want to ask about the current president. And I think this is a lot of, in every state around this country, people care about. It's health care. What do you think of President Trump and health care and what's going on in this country right now?
So obviously the big story is the day-to-day drama in Washington and these hearings, and those are really important, and historically those will be viewed as very important. And I think Democrats have, you know, Democrats and frankly every member of Congress have a responsibility as a co-equal branch of government to scrutinize the Mueller report, ask tough questions of not just Barr today, but Mueller and other witnesses, and make decisions accordingly. But, you know, at the end of the day, we also are approaching this election next year. And I think that perhaps to the average Ohioan, the biggest issues are always, like they are now, and always about issues like jobs, health care, student debt. And so in some ways, you know, there's sort of two tracks right now. There's sort of the investigations of Washington, which I think for a lot of voters, although I think they're important, I think for a lot of voters, it's so ugly that they're not able to, you know, decide which side is worse. I can make strong arguments about who is, but I won't go there right now. But there's also, okay, who's looking out for my health care costs? And who's looking out to make sure that people with pre-existing conditions are able to continue to get coverage? And I think in that area, if Democrats are smart, just like they were in 18, there's huge advantages right now to being the Democratic candidates. I mean, Donald Trump just the other day, I think it was in Green Bay or maybe it was Indianapolis, said, you know, we destroyed a lot of Obamacare and we want to keep going. We want to destroy the whole thing. Obviously in 18, the strength of the pre-existing condition concern led to a lot of those House wins. So I think the most, and of course in Ohio, we've got farms, soybean, and others going under because of the crazy erratic trade policies. And we've got car, you know, GM in Lordstown closing. And Donald Trump said as soon as there was a warning by GM it was going to happen, he said, oh, it doesn't matter. And so I think for the average person, especially when you know that in Ohio, what are the biggest two things Ohioans do? They make cars and they make supplies for cars. And they farm, and especially soybeans. And so to have your major industries under the gun here, partly because of policies like the big tax breaks, and partly because of this chaos around trade, I think the biggest things going on with Donald Trump for a voter is actually around these economic and health care issues. I mean, if people are able to focus on what he really means when he says, we're going to destroy the rest of the ACA, that's basically hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Ohio families losing insurance the next year and a half if he does that. If his court case and Barr's court case in the courts are successful, it would mean the end of protecting for pre-existing conditions. Again, millions of Ohio families affected. So, if you know, aside from all the drama around the Mueller report, the truth is on the issues that matter to people every day on their own kitchen table, Trump is taking some terrible positions that I think the right candidate for president will really highlight, and if they do well, I think they'll go on to win because people don't want to see their health care ripped away, and people in Ohio want to see more auto jobs and farms succeed and not less.
David, in our final 3 minutes here, I think it is important, though, to touch on the Mueller report, because I think when it comes to 2020 and who's going to be the next president, is it going to be the current president continuing, or is it going to be a new president elected? There is a big question right now because of the Mueller report, because we've all seen it. We've all read it, I think, people who are interested. Hearings are being held as we speak about this thing. And the question is if you're a Democrat in Congress before the election of 2020, do you say there is criminal acts in this, high crimes and misdemeanors is how we would define it. There are high crimes and misdemeanors in here. We've got to impeach President Trump. Now, we know there's no chance in the world that the Senate's going to remove him, but we can't let this stand that we did nothing. So pretty much a symbolic impeachment. Or do you say, well, we're just going to vote him out of office and we're going to put all our attention on that and basically forget that the Mueller report ever existed and that money was spent and time and energy? How do you solve that?
I think if you're, again, Republican or Democrat, I think there is a responsibility to sit down with the report. And you know, the investigation and hearings into the report, I think, start off not as a, quote, impeachment hearing, but just digging down into the specifics. You know, there are numerous instances that look like obstruction of justice to a lot of people, and I think that here in Congress, you would be not doing your job to not have Mueller and Don McGahn and others sit through, and you hear and you ask questions and have hearings where they walk through it. And then I think it's a judgment. I can't speak for, you know, the Congress people in Ohio or others, but then it's each individual's judgment about whether or not what they're hearing through those hearings should lead to impeachment hearings. But I also would say, and by the way, every day that we're seeing Attorney General Barr and others looking like they're blocking this stuff or won't let people testify, the more that happens, the more I think it increases the likelihood that Congress has no choice. But be that as it may, what I wouldn't do is that should not be your campaign next year. Your campaign, if you are running for office, but especially president, you're running to sort of independent of that to tell people how you will work to help make their lives better on the issues I talked about. And I do think, what's the term, walk and chew gum at the same time, I think you have to do that as a political figure. Now, some would say, well, there's no way you could ever get any attention to those issues if you're pursuing the Mueller report. I think you have an obligation under the most fundamental principles of our Constitution to be that independent check on the executive, and they have to do that. But I also think my advice to any candidate running next year is, hey, tell people how you're going to help improve their lives and their communities. It's a hard balance, but I think that's the balance you have to, as you said, because it's so unlikely, you know, that the Senate would actually act on impeachment, do removal. I think that you're going to have to go out, whether you're running for president or Congress or some other office, the way you beat your opponent is you explain to the voters how you will make their lives better. And by the way, you're on much stronger ground politically because people don't want to see the end of protection pre-existing conditions. They want to see their costs of medicines go down. If you're fighting on those issues and you're in a fair district, you will go win that election if you've run a good campaign.
The Ohio Democratic Party Chairman, David Pepper. David, it's always a pleasure. Come back anytime. Thank you.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
Bye-bye. David Pepper, there you go. We're done for today, but remember, Nate Redmond coming up at 4:10 to 5 p.m. today. He'll be giving away chances to win tickets to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We've also got the pastor spot with Pastor Steve Whitaker, 3:10 to 4 p.m., and the Trinity Baptist Church Sunday sermon tonight, 6:10 to 7. Don't miss any of it. And I'll talk with you tomorrow. But for this day, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Blue fire. I will do anything you want, Scott. You know I enjoy being on your show. But just let me talking and I keep going.
To the oldest working actor in Hollywood, 100 Norman Lloyd.
Now, did you like